pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome to the second hour of the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Coming up at the bottom of the hour from the Washington Examiner, Eddie Scarry will be with us. Also on the program today, State Auditor Jim Ziegler. I know you're all looking forward to that. And speaking of looking forward to stuff, State Senator Chris Elliott. It's a jam-packed show for you. Really state-heavy today, but why not? No one else is doing it, so we're going to do it. Speaking of things going on in the state, my colleague, my former boss, Del Jackson, this morning reported a rumor that Joe Bonner's wife, Janae Bonner, some of you may know her, had been diagnosed with COVID-19. Governor's office out with a statement on that. This is from Gina Maioli of the governor's office. Says, quote, after attending a visitation with some friends in Mobile last Friday, Joe Bonner's wife, Janae, was notified Monday morning that a number of the attendees had tested positive for COVID-19. While asymptomatic and out of an abundance of caution, Janae was tested and received a positive result. Upon hearing this early Monday morning, Joe Bonner immediately self-quarantined and worked from home. He was not with the governor this week, and Janae has not been around the governor in several months. Joe is continuing to work from home and will not be back in the office until normal CDC protocols for exposure have run. So that got confirmed by the governor's office. Make it what you will. There's always discussions about Governor Ivey and her health. It was used a lot during the 2018 gubernatorial election. I thought that was just kind of a silly thing put out there by our friends at AL.com, Montgomery Advertiser, really wanting to tarnish the governor, who walked away with an easy election in that cycle. But that was, for some reason, there is a fascination with Governor Ivey's health, and this tangentially related to her health, I suppose, being in contact with someone with COVID-19. One thing you see about Governor Ivey on this COVID-19 stuff, she seems like she's taking the right precautions. She's always got the mask on. Not seeing a whole lot of Governor Ivey out and about. So, it's not one of these situations where there is, as people would say, a double standard. How's that? You know, she's living one way and telling you that you have to live another way. She practices what she preaches. But I just wanted to fill you in on that stuff. That is from the governor's office. That seems to be the big news this morning, as it had been reported earlier by my radio show talk show host, colleague Dale Jackson. Back to some other things. I wanted to get into, I wanted to talk about the, we were talking about what might happen if Richard Shelby, he could retire, he may not. So I'm going to lay out some scenarios for you here, ladies and gentlemen. Richard Shelby, the senior senator from Alabama, widely speculated that this might be his last term in the United States Senate. He has served a long stint, and he has earned his way up to the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, a very coveted spot. You really control the purse strings when you're the chairman. Well, let's play this out here. What happens on November 3rd will really impact this, and it all is sort of a domino effect underway here. If Biden wins, it's there stands a pretty good chance for Republicans to lose control of the United States Senate. That would mean Richard Shelby no longer the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. If he's not the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, just a ranking member, why would he stick around? Why would he run for another term in the United States Senate? However, if Republicans maintain the Senate, say Biden somehow wins, but Republicans or Democrats are unable to muster enough seats up in the Senate to get control, and Republicans remain in charge, then he has those 2 years and an additional 2 years after his term is up, his Senate term. He has 2 more years as chairman of the Appropriations Committee, that is. So follow along here. If his term expires in 2022, but his term as the chairman, assuming he wins re-election, would go until 2024. So all of a sudden, there's an incentive there for him to run for re-election. Why? Two more years on Appropriations Committee, one of the most powerful offices in the United States Senate, in all of government, in the country for that matter. And if Biden's president, he still has a big say in these budgets and where money goes, and particularly perhaps could steer more money to the state of Alabama. I think that's the hope of the business community and many in the state. Well, if Biden's president, Republicans somehow maintain control of the United States Senate, and let's say the House, it's not really pertinent to this discussion, whatever happens, it happens with the House of Representatives. You have to think, 2022 is going to be a big year for Republicans because you have a Democrat president. People on the Republican side will come out to vote as a means of protesting against the current president of the United States, and it would be in his interest, perhaps, to run for re-election, get another six-year term, serve out those 2 years as the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. I didn't figure it out in 2024 or whatever. You know, maybe he steps aside as the governor, whoever that might be at the time, appoints someone, whatever that might be. That's scenario number one. Scenario number two, probably a little more likely. Biden wins, Republicans lose control of the Senate. He's no longer Appropriations Chairman. He serves out his 2 years and then doesn't run for re-election, opening up a wide array of possibilities. Because then you had the possibility of the governor's seat being open and the Senate seat being open. Who are the ones you want to watch? Who are the candidates? Obviously, we mentioned Ainsworth earlier in the program, but it's not clear who else is out there. John Merrill, Secretary of State, perhaps. That's possibility number two. Possibility number three is this. Trump wins re-election. Republicans will maintain control of the Senate. 2022 is a big year for Democrats, as typically goes for Democrats, and it typically goes for the party in opposition to the party in power, that 7-year itch, and that was midterms. And I just point to 2006, big wave election, Democrats win the House and the Senate. 2014, another midterm at the end of Obama years, they already had the House and the Republican Party. They pick up some seats, and they get control of the United States Senate. Yeah, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, go figure. And that's your historical reference. So if we're looking at 2022 and Trump's reelected, it's probably going to be a big year for Democrats. Would Richard Shelby run for reelection, knowing that there's a good chance the Republicans could lose control of the Senate? So you see all these possibilities. It's trying to figure all of this out and how this is going to play out. But the reason why it matters right now, obviously what matters right now is November 3rd. What matters heading into 2022 is what happens on November 3rd. And who will run for what. And I bring that up. Would KIV seek another term? Will Ainsworth, Lieutenant Governor, run for United States Senate? So there's a bunch of possibilities out there. And these discussions happen way, way in advance. Obviously you don't formally declare until after this election's over. I would anticipate we start seeing some movement in January, February, March of 2021. If you look back at this last Senate election, look at how early Bradley Byrne announced in 2019 on the heels of the 2018 election. And it came Tommy Tuberville. And very at the last minute there in the fall, Jeff Sessions. Those tended to be the three that were the front runners there. But you start early, particularly if you're from a part of the state. And this is a fascinating thing about Alabama. It's so tribal. There's the northern part of the state, northern candidates. Mo Brooks, let's go back to that special election. Didn't do that well anywhere but the northern part of the state in that 2017 special election primary. Here in the South, 28 in this last go-around in Republican primary, Bradley Byrne running from the 1st Congressional District, sweeps his district and picks up Conecuh County, doesn't do anything beyond that. So knowing that in mind, these candidates start way, way early because they want to build their name ID around the state. It's such a diverse state, and it's so tribal. If you're running for statewide office and you're not from Birmingham, Montgomery, Then you go stake out a claim somewhere in the opposite part of the state. So if you're from Mobile, you go live up in Huntsville for a year, and you spend a lot of time going to meetings and doing campaign appearances up there. If you're from Huntsville, you probably come down here and spend a lot of time in Baldwin County, Mobile County, and whatnot, and work your way up, because you're just trying to build that name ID, that brand. And it takes a long time. It takes years in advance. Well, says don't rule out Bradley Byrd for governor. There's been some speculation about that. Remember, he tried it in 2010. One thing I didn't see in this last primary from Congressman Byrd, though, he was really unable and unable to catch on in the northern part of the state. And they spent some time up there. I was doing my radio show up there in Huntsville, and they had good people working. It for whatever reason, just didn't catch on north of, north of Conecuh County, north of Evergreen. It just couldn't get any traction. Didn't help having the football coach that had universal statewide name ID and the former U.S. senator for 20 years who also had near 100% name ID. But that's what you would need if we ever want to see a politician from Mobile or Baldwin counties win a statewide race. They got to figure out how to build up that name ID. So I don't know what the magic formula is. It didn't work for Congressman Byrd this last go-around. Somebody I thought that was doing, who's somebody you would think, Alexander Shinara, everybody in Alabama knows who that is. And why do we know that? He's got billboards up everywhere, TV commercials. I mean, do you start thinking about that right now if you're Bradley Byrd? Everybody knows. Think of the people that we all know, be it in the Scottsboro or be it in Bayou La Batre, who is somebody that every Alabamian knows? And you start going through, obviously, Nick Saban, people know who he is. Gus Malzahn, any football coach in the last 20 years at Auburn or Alabama. And then who's left? It becomes very celebrity-driven. Are we talking about Charles Barkley or Taylor Hicks? I don't know. It's such a hurdle to get that statewide name ID. You got to start early. But there's a lot of things that got to fall in place, and I think there's a lot of unknowns. But the one guy that seems to be really, really looking ahead to 2022 is Lieutenant Governor Will Ainsworth. And I think you could see an Ivey versus Ainsworth election cycle. That would be fascinating. And it would, in some ways, be kind of like those of you that are paying attention to 2018, to Twinkle Kavanaugh versus Will Ainsworth. It's sort of those same players on both sides, the ag community, the farmers, Alpha, on the Ainsworth side. You probably had the business community and those entities on the Ivy side. But this is all speculation, and we hadn't even gotten through this election. But I think you're seeing a lot of things going on right now. Just to look ahead, and we're all playing 3D chess at this point. I think you've seen a lot of things fall into place right now, a lot of discussions being had based on, for 2022, we're talking about local politics, we're talking about statewide politics. And yes, we had to get through this election. But this election is going to tell us a lot of things, because it's so interconnected with not just the state level, but the federal level, who our senior senator is, what his decision is, because he's tough to beat. Many have tried to defeat one Richard Shelby in a Republican primary and failed. Probably have a former Democrat in a Democratic primary as well. So I think if Shelby wants to run again in 2022, should be tough to beat no matter what. All right, guys, we're going to take a time out. We'll move on to some other stuff. This has been the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Say I got a whole lot of cares in the redneck Riviera. It's getting crazy. I'm getting hammered, sitting right here at the floor of Bama. At the floor of Bama. I can't get to sleep at night. The parking lot's so loud and bright. The AC hasn't worked in 20 years. Probably never made it. To the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you. So good to be with you. Been holding on the line for a while. I want to get to this phone call. Jay at Mobile. Let's talk about the census. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind?
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I got a question about the 2020 census. We've been talking about it, and I hear Sean talk about it a lot, and you guys. And I guess my question is, you know, they talk about we've got so many congressional seats right now. I think it's, what, 7? And they say, if you don't fill out your census, you're just going to go down to 6. My question is, who picks which congressional, you know, which congressman goes away?
Right.
How does that go? You know, is it the most junior guy, which would be?
Not necessarily. The legislature gets to draw the lines, and they can do things. Because this is constitutional, but the legislature would draw the new lines, the 6 districts, and they can make it where it favors a member over another. So, for example, if you had to start combining districts, so let's say member X is from Mobile, member Y is from Dothan, and those two go head-to-head, well, then you could get more people in the Mobile area that would favor the Mobile candidate. The legislature could do all of that. So that's a very good question, Jay.
So I get it. I just feel that we could be really shortchanged in this process, you know, especially with we're going to have a junior congressman one way or the other coming out of this election.
Hey, thanks for the call, Jay. Oh yeah, but that's another fascinating thing we need to watch in the legislature in 2021 is how if Alabama does indeed lose a House seat, who stands to gain, who stands to lose. There's been a lot of talk in the past about combining 1 and 2. You'll have 2 junior members with Barry Moore coming in the second, or likely coming in second, being that's a very Republican district, and Jerry Carl similarly in the Republican side. You'd have 2 freshmen going head-to-head. Well, the more senior members of the delegation, Mike Rogers and Robert Adderholt in particular, are such big players based on their seniority, their standing, their ability to raise money, they might be protected. Otherwise, you have a very, I would say, Mo Brooks, very popular among voters, not very popular among the big mules and the planters. He's a guy that's ideological and doesn't just work to get things passed for business interest or special interest. They may try to draw him out and increase Robert Adderholt's standing there. But the one theory I hear that makes sense about redistricting, make of this what you will, Gary Palmer has he was on the show the other day. He has 6 congressional district. That's Birmingham, south of town there. Also gets up north into Blount County. Anyway, he is term limited himself. He looks to have eyes on something else. They could divvy up his district where you would move the seat Martha Roby occupies right now, where Barry Moore likely will occupy in the future. You could move that up into Shelby County, up closer to south of Birmingham. Mike Rogers comes west in the third and gets St. Clair County there, and they expand that, and then they move Robert Adderholt south into what's left, and you have no longer have a 6 congressional district. It goes away, and everything kind of stays roughly the same. You may have to draw the lines a little differently for the 7th congressional district. Terry Sewell, the lone Democrat, her district is losing population. But she may have to go in other places to pick up members or pick up population. Because what'll happen is if they draw this, we're right on the precipice of 6 or 7, and you got to find more numbers. But you want a minority-majority district, as the 7th is, and that's the Black Belt, that's parts of Birmingham, parts of Montgomery. Possibility, we could be looking at this. We could look at Terry Sewell's district coming into Mobile County, picking up parts of Pritchard, parts of Mobile. You could have 2 members of Congress where you didn't used to have them, perhaps, if needed. That they need to pick up that population. So that's one of the fascinating things that's going to go on. It's very complicated. You really got to have an understanding of the geography and how voters vote, and really the politics of the state. Because politics, while they will tell you, we're going to draw this the best way we know how. That's obviously not how it works. The state's going to look out for its best interest, and my guess is they're going to protect their most valuable members in the House of Representatives. Those are the more senior guys. With Roby leaving, the seconds up to big time alterations with Bradley Byrne leaving, the same thing applies. But there's a place there if Gary Palmer does leave after this term and runs for something else, and many signs are pointing toward the United States Senate, that could be the odd district out. And you could redraw that in a way where everybody in these other districts picks up a little bit. Maybe you move the second congressional district out of Dothan and Enterprise, and you give the first congressional district would go all the way from Mississippi all the way to Georgia. So it would be a very ag-heavy district if that were to happen. But it's interesting stuff. We'll probably talk more on that as the months unfold. We're going to take a time out. We will return. This is the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Living on the road, my friend, was gonna keep you free and clean.
'Cause you see, I'm a dinosaur. I should have died out a long time before. Have pity on a dinosaur. Hand me my hat. Man, but where's the door?
And welcome back to the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you. Still to come on the program today in the 11 a.m. hour, we'll hear from State Auditor Jim Ziegler and State Senator Chris Elliott. Make sure you stay tuned for that. Lots to talk about there. But join us now, a friend of mine, very great writer for the Washington Examiner, columnist. I read him regularly. Eddie Scarry joins us on the line. Eddie, how are you this morning?
Doing good, Jeff. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. We tried to get you last week, but you still on vacation, or you back in the swing of things?
I wouldn't say I'm back in the swing of things. However, I did just get back in D.C. To resume, hopefully at some point, the swing of things. Just last night.
well, thank you for making time on the triumphant return. I'm certain it's triumphant. Let's get right into it. Kamala Harris, Joe Biden's pick. You've written a lot about it. What's your initial reaction to kind of where things are with this presidential race?
Well, I thought it was probably the most obvious pick. I thought that it was also his best pick. And every time I said that, anytime I said it to a conservative, they said, no, that would be his worst pick. And I think I never really quite figured out why. They would always do an answer like, she's a cop, or she's too cold. I never really seemed like a really good reason why. I always thought one because he. I always thought whoever the nominee was would eventually pick a black running mate, whether it was a man or a woman, and that's simply because they don't want to recreate what Hillary Clinton did in 2016, where she saw the black vote drop off by about 6%, which is basically catastrophic to her campaign. But so she picked that box, rather black, attractive, and at least comes across as very competent. You know, when you hear her talk, you have confidence that she knows what she's talking about, that she can get things done. She, you know, is familiar with policy, familiar with the facts. So all those things I saw in her and thought that was the smartest choice. And I do think that she's going to be. It's going to be difficult for the Trump campaign to define her in a way that's repulsive to voters.
Well, you say she's a safe pick, but it's not one of these situations where you have Sarah Palin and it seems like a Hail Mary pass. They actually almost pulled it off there. It seems like the safe pick would suggest to me that they're not really worried about the who's on the Democratic ticket as much as they are about making this the whole thing about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that's true. However, again, I think, you know, he the whole identity politics stuff, like I write about in my book, Privileged Victims, is still very much at play and still very much matters within the Democratic Party. That's why he made sure to say he was going to pick a woman. That's why it did end up being a black woman. But I think this whole thing right now, the thing what the Trump campaign needs to do to make something stick, really, is to stop calling her a cop, trying to make something out of that. I don't think that's going to work. I think people actually like cops. If there's one thing we could have learned in the last 2 weeks, it's that people kind of like cops and they kind of depend on them. But instead, push the Biden-Harris ticket to basically own all of the Black Lives Matter chaos. To make them, either they're going to have to criticize the looting, the rioting, the vandalism, the theft, all of it, and say that that's wrong and that can't be going on, and actually acknowledge that it is happening. or they're going to not want to offend what makes up a large part of the Democratic Party's base, and then just repel independents, moderates, even some perhaps right-leaning voters who don't like Trump. But if you just turn, you repel those people, you turn off your base, that should be what I think. That should be what the Trump campaign should be trying to do with Biden and Harris.
What do you think, though? Does it bolster the ticket, or does it just kind of maintain its ground by bringing her? Because if they had gone in another direction, say Susan Rice or whomever, the way the media are reacting is it's almost as if Kamala Harris is at the top of the ticket, which is not the case. But that seems to be the way it's being treated. With that in mind, I mean, it seems like there's trying to force in some enthusiasm for the Democrat ticket.
I think that's true. There is a degree of novelty to Harris. You're right, she's not like a Palin where she just kind of came out of nowhere. As people have known her, she did run for president unsuccessfully, but people do know her from that. They know her from the Kavanaugh hearings. But she is youthful. I think that is an element there. They like that she's a minority. They like that it's a woman. They like that she's useful, a liberal woman. So I think that you're right, that they're trying to force some sense of, wow, there's this new life for the Biden campaign, because he gets exhumed every couple days to come to come above ground. And so now they've got someone who actually has seen the sunlight for more than, 10 minutes at a time. But we'll see what happens.
Well, I mean, the whole thing with Biden, we've never experienced something like this. Obviously, these are unique times with COVID-19 and what you need to do to stay healthy. But at some point, are people going to say, you want to be president of the United States, that's going to require you taking some risk with your health and getting out and about, that he can't remain in the bunker just until the election?
Yeah, and I see the push to kind of make that happen by his friends in the media saying that he shouldn't debate, basically stay out of the public eye as long as possible. Just let's keep doing this this COVID stuff and really, keeping Trump on his heels with this and let him destroy himself. But no, there will come a point where people do need to hear from the person they're expected to vote for, and I think it's not enough for them to say, no, we're just going to let Trump completely, crater and hope that happens. And I believe they're certain it's going to happen, but I'm not so sure. I still think that there's time for the Trump campaign to come back, and obviously it really is going to make a difference with those debates, and Biden really can't hide from those.
I mean, it seems to me it's tightening right now. The summer's always kind of an outlier, and then as we get closer and closer to election day, things tighten. How much stock do you take into what we see with the national poll? Is good for trends, but it's not a real indicator of where this election is going to be on November 4th.
Yeah, I think that they can be useful. Polls can be useful, but they clearly don't tell you everything, and oftentimes they are just flat out wrong. I think the Biden campaign knew that, because that's, I think, again, why they wanted to commit to a black person being on the ticket, because they know that there is still the chance. Even if people say in polls, oh yeah, I'm going to vote for him, I approve him, it's another thing to see who actually gets out of their house, who goes and actually does it, who even fills out a ballot and takes the time to mail it in. All those things are not necessarily taken into consideration when you look at polls.
Yeah, well, they are banking on this is what I thought, where they made the mistake in 16, was they were relying on they relied on several assumptions that only pertain to a candidate like Barack Obama, the first African American president, which meant the big cities were going to show up, and they took that for granted. you can't just say, well, Kamala Harris is the new Obama, and that's, it doesn't seem like that's going to work in the same way, and you're going to get black voter turnout up where it needs to be for Democrats to do as well as they think they're going to do.
Yeah, and I think that's the Trump campaign looks at it from the other end and says, we had all these people that were not voting in previous elections, so they were completely written off, and we expect that. I guess they look at the numbers and look at voter enthusiasm, and that's where they're most concerned, is they're saying, well, even if the majorities of people in swing states, even swing states, are saying that they're for Biden, our people are the ones saying we're excited to go and vote, whereas Biden's is way, way down there. So they're saying, you know, you might have the numbers on your side as far as favorability goes, but it's about getting the people to show up for you. And Trump believes, the campaign certainly believes, that enthusiasm is on his side. And I will say, when I talk with Trump voters back, I'm from South Carolina, if I talk with them, anyone who likes him, including certain relatives, they really are committed to him, and they want to see him again. They want him to have another term. They believe that there's a disaster on the corner if he doesn't. So I think that there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, and I just turnout's a mystery as it is for anything in these circumstances. You know, will they be able to get? It's always strange to me that the discussion seems to be centered around, well, if you want to win in 2020, you got to get the suburban soccer mom or whatever. Whatever moniker you want to use for that demographic. And maybe that is the case, but I'm not concerned. I mean, I'm not convinced that's a certainty.
I agree with that as well. I think, you know, I think that there's something implied that there is something insidious about Trump trying to suppress certain voter turnout. But it's really just a strategy of saying, you know what, a certain group of people, whether it's black men, you know, there's a push by the campaign to target black men, for example, and he's saying, you know what, you may not actually get up and go vote for me, but if I convince you that there's no reason to go vote for the other person, that's effectively as good as a vote for me. And I think the Trump campaign really, really goes hard with that strategy. I think they're actually trying to do that with, you know, tweeting out the things about the suburban housewives, the terms he's using. And they're basically just trying to say to them, look, these are the things that we've done that we believe you'll like. And maybe you don't like me, but if you like this that I've done, you won't go pull for the other guy.
Right. Well, while that's, you know, it's always like you're trying to figure out, you know, what's the 3D chess game here or whatever. For the Trump campaign, but the one thing that I think the media, while they are decidedly anti-Trump, they don't seem like they're going to have as, and it just seems every election cycle their relevance is diminished. This election cycle, they go harder and harder, but their relevance in the whole discussion seems to get smaller and smaller. Do you think that trend is a part of this election, that maybe the media are less of a player in 2020 for voters?
I'm a little bit torn on that, because on the one hand, you do have just them repeating the same thing day in and day out, largely in unison. That you can't tell the difference between CNN and MSNBC anymore. What they say on the opinion pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, any of them, they're all just saying the same thing over and over again. So you do have this massive wall of just repetition and saying Trump is bad, Trump is a racist, the coronavirus is killing everyone, yada yada. I still believe that has some impact, but otherwise it's also possible that the repetition just gets so old. Right now they're calling him a racist for not even saying really anything about this question he got at the press briefing yesterday about whether Kamala Harris was whether she was is eligible to become president because her parents were immigrants when she was born, whatever. But, you know, they never called it racist when Trump said the same thing about Ted Cruz. Why is it only racist because it happens to be Kamala Harris, who happens to be black? So I think people just hear that and they go, you know, do we really, you're just saying the same thing over and over again, and it's about time we just start tuning you out. So on the one hand, it does have some effect, I think, but like you're saying, it just gets smaller and smaller every single year.
Well, that's a fascinating thing. It's almost like a neo-birtherism or something, that this is, they poll tested, or they thought that Donald Trump going after Barack Obama before he was president for his birth certificate was something they could make hay with and depict him as a racist. Did it almost seems as if they're trying to engineer the same phenomenon, except this time with Kamala Harris? Because I, you know, where did this come from? This storyline, it just seemed to have come out of nowhere until the, you know, the last couple of days.
Right, and I mean, I guess it started with that piece by someone I had never heard of, but in Newsweek, where they were saying, they were suggesting that, you know, and there's a lot of people who do believe that this is not a settled issue, that just because you were born in the U.S., that doesn't necessarily in and of itself make you a U.S. citizen. So there is that still out there, but I think even the president seemed kind of caught off guard, and as if he didn't really know what to say. He hadn't really thought anything about it when he was asked that question, and that's basically what he said. Like, I don't know anything about it. Yeah, sure, that's a serious question, but I don't know.
It's
but
like
suddenly the New York Times calls it racist.
It's like the time when George Stephanopoulos pulled the birth control question on Mitt Romney. It's you see a setup underway here almost with the new birtherism.
Oh yeah. Asking him randomly about David Duke.
Right.
Any one of these questions that just kind of comes out of nowhere, that it's like, who was talking about that? Who even thought of David Duke in the last, you know, 20 years? You know, but no, it is, you know, they try to take this really divisive issue, and oftentimes, to their credit, it works. I think it worked to a large extent on Mitt Romney's campaign. I think that they didn't really know what to do with it, and I don't know what that is. That's up to smarter minds in the Republican Party, but no, it does work sometimes.
Hey, anyway, we're about out of time here. Before I let you go, three things, actually. Tell folks where they could get your book, Privilege Victims, or where they could find you on social media, where they can read your columns on the Washington Examiner.
Yeah, find me at the Washington Examiner. You can follow all of my work on Twitter. It's @eScary, scary with two R's. My book, Privilege Victims, How America's Culture Fascists Hijacked the Country and Elevated Its Worst People, is so timely right now. It just came out this year, but you can go get it on Amazon easily at Amazon.com, or you can find it at Barnes & Noble. Or if you want to go to a physical bookstore and they don't have it, just ask them to get it for you and they'll get it.
Eddie, as always, thanks for making time for us.
All right, thanks, Jeff.
That was Eddie Scarry of the Washington Examiner. We're going to take a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Rock and roll. I keep on rolling with the flow. He asked me how I bought it. I told him on credit. Daddy just smiled. I'll never forget it. Daddy never was the Cadillac kind.
And welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you. Still to come on the program. Warming up in the bullpen right now. Join us in studio here in just a moment. State Auditor Jim Ziegler, he'll be with us. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from State Senator Chris Elliott. That's all coming up in the next hour. Make sure that you stay tuned for that. Read a couple of tweets and text here. Freddie writes, we continue to be the redheaded stepchild because we're south of Goat Hill. Hey, there's kind of a phenomenon everywhere in this state. Not so much anymore in the northern part of the state. The trick with those guys, their legislative delegations really work together, this quadrennium. Well, not so to say it's not happening down here, but the northern part of the state kind of had the same mentality about being left out of the mix when it came to Montgomery. That, you know, it whenever you're in these polar opposites, but it's just, you hear the same thing from the folks in the Shoals and in Dothan. It's when you're in these extremes in the state, you got to do something extra. And I'm not exactly sure what that is, but you know, that has been a long-standing criticism of how Montgomery functions, particularly with this part of the state. So it's just a geography; it's tribal, and every side. It's one of the most. If we have any division in state politics in Alabama, it's not ideological; it's not partisan; it's geographic. It's north versus south. It's maybe it's you know, it's not even Auburn or Alabama, although those two have their own, you know, turf wars from time to time. But it's geographic, and that's kind of you got to figure out how to overcome that. We got to take a timeout. We will return. This is the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Hand me my hat. Excuse me, man, but where's the door?